And I got out. I come running back to you. I come running back to you. Yeah, I come running back to you.
Welcome to the Wayne Bennett Podcast, celebrating West Virginia's people, places, and the culture of Southern Appalachia. Now here's your host, Wayne Bennett.
Welcome to Wayne Bennett's podcast. This is Wayne Bennett, and it's August the 23rd, 2023, and this is episode 111. And our guest today is returned from, he was here a little over a year ago, and retired newspaper executive and an old Sophia Blue Hawk, Sophia High School Blue Hawk, and Mr. Bob Clay. Welcome, Bob.
Good to be here again. Let me first say I enjoy your iPod so much because it keeps me in touch with Beckley and Raleigh County and a lot of folks I don't know, but I know what they you know, it all relates to the days I was here. So I really, really enjoy it. Thank you so much.
I appreciate that. I enjoy talking to these people. The last interview we had, you know, we talked about your fishing, and we didn't get into it too in depth. And so one of the reasons why I wanted to get you back, you fished all over North America. I mean, and how did you get started in fishing? I mean,
when I was growing up, I spent quite a bit of time at my grandmother's and my first cousin, Garland Aleph, he lives in Bluefield now, and we were just kids, and we made our own poles and, you know, stole fishing hooks if we had to, and we, you know, just fished in Ike's Fork and Muzzle Creek, and when we were just a little bit older, 12 years old, we'd walk 5 miles all the way down to Huff Creek to fish Huff Creek. And we just, you know, just absolutely loved it. We did that every summer for a long, long time.
Now, is that the Huff Creek that feeds into the Guyandot?
Yes.
Okay. Now, yeah. That's a walk.
Oh, it's about 5 miles one way. And we'd get it late. We'd get home late after dark a few times, and Grandma did not like that.
What was your first reel that you actually had?
Well, the first one I actually was proud of, and I had a great friend who lived down the street. His name was Bobby Arms. And Bob's well known all around Sophia. He took me under his wing. He's a little bit older. And he would practice casting in his yard, in his lawn. And there it was, a beautiful Zibco 33 in that line. I thought, you know, I have to have that. That's what I have to have. And I saved up my money. And I think they cost at that time like $19.95. I could be wrong, could be $9.95. But I saved up my money and finally got it together and bought that Zebco 33 and in Montgomery Ward's and a Montgomery Ward rod. And boy, I was proud of that. And I practiced all the time. And Bobby, we all were, he was a little bit closer to Neil Lacey. And Neil's dad, of course, was Coach Lacey. Uh-huh. And Coach had a camp down on the Greenbrier. And Bobby and I would tag along with the coach and fish that hole down there where his camp was. And it was just wonderful. But let me add a little bit about Zibco 33s. It changed the world. It changed the whole fishing world. Before World War II, the only rods around were made out of wood or even steel or something like that. There wasn't any man-made materials. But after World War II, because of the war, nylon came into fashion, fiberglass came into the mix, et cetera, et cetera. And so they were making rods, Orvis and all those guys were making rods, out of these new materials, man. It was, but it ran bamboo completely. I mean, just off the market. It took a real big hit. But the Zebco reels was part of this whole change because a guy named Hull, he kept saying there's got to be a better way than the old bait caster reel that will backlash all the time. And he noticed that in butcher shops, they had a cone of butcher cord, and it came off. It came off of that cone. It never got tangled. Nothing ever. And he thought, man, there's got to be a way to make a fishing reel like that. And that was the beginning of it.
I'm a darn.
And there was a company. He's from Tulsa, and there was a company called the Zero Hour Bomb Company. And they got together. They made bombs. I don't know exactly what the deal is here, but they made these things that would blast for oil drilling. They would blast the rock and to get through the rock. So anyway, they ended up with the machines and stuff at Zero Hour Bomb Company start making these reels. And they just changed the world. You push that button and flip it, and there you go. And there was no backlash and none of all the problems. And then the nylon rods and the fiberglass rods came in, and it was all different.
Yeah. Well, of course, things aren't like they used to be. My experience with the Zebco 33 has taken place a couple years ago. I bought some. There was a local sporting goods store that was expanding, and they were having a sale after they got all the renovations done. And so I was going to buy my grandkids, my granddaughter, some Zebco 33s, and they had them on sale. I mean, they were only like $16 or something like that. And I bought three of them. And when I took it up to the counter, the guy said, if you have any problems with these, you got to contact the company. Don't bring them back here. And I said, well, that's a red flag, And he said, you'll probably be fine. Well, sure enough, I took the three reels. One of them didn't work at all.
Oh, wow.
One of them worked perfectly and still does. And the other one worked a while and then didn't work. And I never did call the company or anything like that, and just kind of let it go. But it's kind of like even with some of the other machines and stuff out there, they just don't make them like they used to.
They sure don't.
Maybe I just had bad luck.
Well, the old ones, even the one that I bought, it was all metal inside. It wasn't plastic or nylon or the gears and whatnot.
Uh-huh.
And the brads that hold the reel to the handle were much, much better. And there's a little pin in the thing that actually picks up the line. And normally, you either lose that pin or it disappears for some reason. And they went through several. Brunswick bought them in the, I want to say, 60s. And ever since that, Brunswick tried to make money and not make a good, and then they sold, and it's owned by some conglomerate.
Yeah. Now, you fished a guy in Dodd, Tank Fork.
Yeah. My brother he was 10 years older than me, and Joe Clay, and I looked up to him, and every time he and his family lived in Ohio. So every time he came to visit, we would load up and go to the Guyandotte, down around Baileysville and then in that area, or over around Jaeger on the Tug Fork. And all there was catfish. Uh-huh. Those rivers ran absolutely black, just black, because of washing coal and coal falling, getting in the river, and it absolutely, totally black. And the only thing was catfish. We fished with spam. It was treat or spam. And you cut little blocks off of it, and you had to cast it very smoothly, and we'd throw it off. But we cast it. It's fish all night, talk all night.
That was before the R.D. Bailey Dam was built and stuff.
Yeah.
The Guyandotte now, they kind of control the flow and that kind of stuff from the dam. They have in June, I think, they have what they call a yak festival, the kayak festival. And they float 14 miles and they get down to St. Albans around that area. And then they have like a 2-day party. Wow. I mean, bands come in. And I don't think there's a lot of fishing going on because, I mean, they have like 2,000-3,000 kayakers.
Yeah, I read where, you know, they stock the upper end of the Guyandotte and even the upper end of the Tug Fork. And you know, in my mind, I mean, that's almost impossible to think that way because they were just wasteland. I mean, wasted water. I mean, yeah. They were all, you know, had all kinds of sewer going into them and everything. And so, but I guess they've cleaned them up, you know, and I hope so. I hope it's successful.
Can you, is it legal to set a trot line anymore, or was it legal?
Yeah, as far as I know. I mean, yeah, I'm not that familiar with West Virginia laws anymore, but I wouldn't think there was any reason not to.
Yeah, I can remember younger, we used to set trot lines on the Greenbrier River, and sometimes we'd get inebriated, wouldn't check them that night, or you know, when we're supposed to, but I didn't know whether it was even legal anymore, but or if it was legal then. But now they had, along with the Zebco 33s, they had reels like the Mitchell, the Shakespeare, and Garcia. Yeah.
The spinning reels were originated in France, and they're about the same time. They became popular about the same time. They are still very, very popular today. And baitcasters, back in the old days, I mean, like we were saying, they backlash so bad. And you just really had to be skilled to keep from them backlashing. But the new ones, they have anti-magnetic systems that will slow that line down and not backlash nearly like they used to. It's like, you know, so many other things. The improved technology is terrific.
Now, I know a lot of out-of-state people, if I run into them and you're from West Virginia, and they'll talk about fishing on the Cranberry River. You've had a lot of experience up there.
Wonderful, wonderful times on the Cranberry. First time I went, it was in college, and had a bunch of guys that lived up in Somerville and up in that area. And they fished, they had fished there forever. So they got, you know, we would go in five, six, in the early days, five, six guys, freeze to death. I mean, absolutely freeze to death. And the fishing was so great, it wasn't even funny. And later, my brother would bring Ohio folks down. And we'd have, in the spring, we would have, at one time, we had as many as 20 guys in our group, and it was a mess. And
we had to walk in there, wouldn't you?
Oh yeah, we walked in it. You know, 6 to 8 miles before we camped. We all wore hats. We all had hats alike, so we'd know they were in our group. And my brother brought these. Was a specialist, one old boy down there, and man, the fish and game folks caught him, and he had like 8 trout in it and a creel. And they took his reel, rod and reel, and his fish. And it was really hard to keep up with that many guys because it was like 6 per person and 12 possession. That meant in camp, if you had more than 12 per person, you were, well, with that many people, it's almost... So we ate fish for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And it was so hard to keep up. A year or two later, the conservation officers came by and saw our hats, and he came over to me and he said, "Hey, is that old boy from Ohio in your group today, this year?" And I said, "No, he never came back." He said, "Well, let me tell you, get word back to him that we have a warrant for his arrest." And if he gets stopped for speeding or jaywalking or anything, he's going to jail. He never came back.
I reckon. But do you ever fish Summit Lake up there?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, that's up on the hill there. Yeah. And I used to get at a mini triathlon, and you had to swim across some lake and back, and then get on a bicycle and ride, and then run. And the race was in July, and it was the coldest water I've ever seen. It's good trout fishing from what I heard, but man, even in July, that water was cold up there. But I think they still have that thing. But now, one place that you fished, I've never, in West Virginia, I've never even been there, was the South Branch of the Potomac.
Wonderful.
And do you float that? Or?
Well, that's why I still lived here. Again, you know, several of us, Paul Fisher and Foster and Trico and Maskell, and we all loaded up and wanted forever to fish what they call the trough. And it's from Moorefield to Romney. And there's no vehicles, no cars, there's nothing. It's like the New River, a mini New River Gorge.
Yeah.
And boy, we fished that. And I fished some other parts of it in other years, but it was just absolutely awesome. I mean, you're just alone, and you could hear the guys down there talking just like they were in this room. It was just beautiful. And we caught enough fish to eat on as we camped, and we camped two nights coming out of there. It was about 16 or 17 miles through there.
That thing, it goes through the Smoke Hole Cavern, doesn't it?
Back up.
Farther north?
Further upstream, yeah.
Upstream.
Now, I fished downstream, too, around from Harper's Ferry, around Harper's Ferry and down. And it's a really good stream down that way.
You ever wondered about the names of fish? I mean, I can understand a fish, a red eye or a bluegill or even a walleye, you know, but like trout, I wonder where that came from. I've always, somebody told me it meant nibble or something, a nibbler or something, but I always kind of wondered where certain, and fish is such a species.
Yeah, I really don't know. I mean, I never really studied that, but trout's a very interesting fish. The rainbow trout, and it's kind of hard to believe this, but rainbow trout are indigenous to the Pacific coast.
Really?
And they were introduced all over the world. And they did, you know, they prospered here. The brookie trout that is the only native trout we actually have is the brook trout. And that's for all of the Atlantic side. The Germans, the European brown trout, are originally from Europe. So, and they do really well. On the White River of Arkansas, I caught my personal best brown trout, and it was about 20 pounds.
Really?
Yeah, it was a monster. Well, to me, I mean, there's bigger ones caught, but that's my personal best brown trout.
Now, you mentioned the White River, one, I think in our last interview, is one of your favorite places, Do you go to, they got a Bull's Shoal State Park, or do you ever went there?
You know, they got a lake above Bull's Shoals, right. You know, I never fished it much because you got about 30 miles good trout fishing below the dam. And almost all the species are in there, even cutthroat, which is indigenous to the West. I mean, it's catching. You know, it's catching. It's not fishing. It's just wonderful.
Yeah. What about the striper bass? You don't have striper bass in West Virginia, do you?
I'm not sure, and I'm putting it in parentheses because I don't know. But what striper bass were? They call them rock. I actually call them rockfish in some parts of the Eastern Seaboard. They're an ocean fish, and they migrate all the way from, South Carolina all the way up to Nova Scotia, probably.
Huh.
And they go up, and they go down, and they go up to the Chesapeake Bay. And they spawn in the rivers. And somewhere along the line, in the Santee area of South Carolina, they got trapped. And they thought they'd just, you know, probably just die off. And they did, and they did really good. They, you know, they did extremely well. So lots and lots of lakes are stocked. I fished Lake Texoma for stripers, and boy, it's great. I mean, it is just a great place to striper fish. And I've caught my share of stripers, but some of these boys, I mean, they really, I mean, they go all out to catch the big boys.
He was going to tell me a story about going to Canada with a bunch of buddies.
Well, I'll try to tell it as fast as I can. Because
now, all these guys were off home confinement, right?
I worked at the newspaper here, and Frank Wood, who later became publisher, was a salesman. And he and his family went up to Ontario, Canada, every year or so. And, you know, he was telling me all about how great it was. And I said, I gotta go, man. So I got the few guys together, same old bunch, Trico and Darlington. And we had Randy Hoover and Paul Fisher, Pete's brother, Steve. And we saved up for a year. We had a little club, and we put, I think it was like $50, $100 a month into the club. So by the time we got to the trip, we had most of it paid. And this is we were in our mid-20s, late 20s, and this was in the late 70s, perhaps. So anyway, we take off, you know, and somehow, I guess it was legal, but somehow Steve Tirico borrowed a brand new Volkswagen van. And we loaded up in that, had nets and rods and anybody. I mean, it was something. We took off that morning. We headed toward Canada, a little place called Jellicoe. And we didn't know exactly how far it was. We got to Columbus, Ohio, and it was about lunchtime, you know. And they had never had any White Castles. And I kind of grew up and spent a lot of summer time in Ohio here and there. And oh man, we gotta get some White Castles here. So we got off and found a White Castle. And I said, now the way you order these is by the dozen. You know, and he looked at me like I was crazy or something. I said, no, you don't buy one or two. You buy, you know, you're six or eight or a dozen. So that there were six of us in there, and we bought, I don't know how many dozen. And so we changed drivers, and Darlington was driving out. And we were all starting to eat our hamburgers. And he was going down no more than 200 feet or so. And there was a cop at an intersection on foot. He waved us over. He waved us over. And he said, where are you boys going? So we're going to Canada fishing, you know, and he could look around. And he said, well, you've been going down this street the wrong way, on a one-way street. And, you know, we did. And he said, well, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. He said, I'm gonna let you boys go this time. But are you whip this thing around, and there's about two blocks down, there's a drugstore there. And I want you to stop at that drugstore and buy all the Rolaids they got, because you're going to need them. And then there's an interstate right past there, and I never want to see you in Columbus again. But it was a long, long trip, and we caught tons of fish, and they got stuck. We got, I'll finish it as fast as I can. We finally got ready to go, get out of there. You know, we had planes that took you in, and there was so many of us, we had to take two of the small planes, bush planes, to get us in.
So you drove to a certain point.
Yeah, Jellicoe.
And you had to fly
another 160 miles or something. And the only real food we had was a little bit of flour and this and that and the other, and a salted ham. They used to see them hanging on markets and stuff, and because we ate fish, and we couldn't carry so much stuff in there. So the plane landed, loaded everything up, And he said, well, I can only take three of you. So we draw straws to see who was going. And I got out with Randy Hoover and Paul Fisher. And then, so the other three got, were there, and they were going to wait on the next plane. And a storm came, a huge storm came. And they got stranded. And we were back there eating steaks and having a great time back at the hotel. Cleaned up with them, you know, in the shower and the whole bit. And finally, we found out they weren't coming. They weren't going to be there till sometime tomorrow. And they were stuck up there, and they had no food because we took all the fishing stuff too. With us back, and no food, and they went out in the woods and dug up or found that old ham bone and came back and fixed water gravy.
Oh my God.
They weren't real happy with this one.
Time to eat nuts and berries or something, whatever. Somewhere along the line, you got interested in fly fishing, and when did that take place?
I think I mentioned before, but I bought newsprint for the newspaper, and that most of the newsprint companies back in those days had camps in Canada, and like Abitibi and Domtar and several of them, that's where their plants were. And I always wanted to get invited. I just never did. I didn't buy enough, I guess. And then when I started working in Charleston, we bought considerably more than Beckley or somewhere. And I got invited to a trip up in Labrador. And fly fishing only. All these were fly fishing only for salmon, Atlantic salmon. And I said, man, I don't know about this fly fishing deal. They said, oh, don't worry about it. We'll teach you. it was the most frustrating 4 days of my life. I could not get it 25 feet out there. And I finally caught one the last day I was there. And I was kind of embarrassed, but it was also, you know, a challenge. And I bought a Cabela's little outfit when I got back, rod and reel in line. And I lived on the golf course. Every evening I'd go out there and practice. Because I wanted to go on that next trip and be able to catch some fish. And then I started taking lessons, and started going to schools, started doing this and that and the other, and getting better all the time. And then I thought, well, I want to get a certified from the FFI and start teaching some and bring some other folks along. Because I struggled so much getting started that I wanted to help and enjoyed it, you know, enjoy the company and camaraderie of fly fishermen.
In the school, did they teach you the history of fly fishing?
A little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. It depended. I went to, it was a week long. No, it's about three or four days long at L.L. Bean School. And it was really concentrated. But it goes way, way back. Now, in the United States, this guy named Leonard, and how they figured it out, I don't know. These guys started figuring out how to split bamboo and make beautiful classic pieces of art almost out of fly rods and make them work. And they used silk line. You had to really treat it with kid gloves to make it work. And even the leaders, which goes on the end of the fly line, was silk, catgut silk. And that's the way they fished from 1860 or so to World War II, as far as fly fishing. Then graphite came, or fiberglass came along, and other.
Which do you prefer, bamboo or graphite, or
for the pure casting? You cannot beat a graphite. You can't. You just can't beat a graphite. As part of the test, one of the things is distance casting. And you have to cast 70 feet for the certification, and for the masters, 90 feet. And it's a challenge. And, you know, the flat bellies, it's like golf. You know, they can do that without a whole lot. But all the, you know, when you're older, it's a challenge.
Now, you became a certified fly fishing instructor, which there's very few of those people around, are there?
There's
only, I think, a couple in West Virginia.
I think there's three in West Virginia.
Three, wow. What do you tell somebody if they're getting interested, they want to take they want to get the instruction? How do you start them out?
A lot of people just take, you know, will just take you to the stream and do, you know, you just start throwing it basically and do this and do that. But if you go to a school, they're going to tell you what the basics are. It's just like the basics of throwing a baseball or a football or the intricacies of technique and you build from there. The stroke itself is a real challenge to get it. You see these little South Korean ladies can hit that golf ball 300 yards.
Yeah.
And it's a kind of this, it's not just strength, it's technique. And same thing with a fly cast. Same thing with fly fishing. You just don't pick it up and throw it.
Yeah.
You want to learn. A lot of folks, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with this, nothing at all. They learn to a certain degree for their specific area, you know, like Cranberry or Second Creek or wherever, and they're fine with that. They enjoy it every time they go, and they don't want to be challenged. You know, it's the quiet, the scenery, the birds, the flowers, the sky, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's beautiful. But a lot of folks just want to get involved in other things like fly casting, fly tying. Some folks just like adventures and they spend money every year going somewhere. Uh-huh. You know, I've known people went to Christmas Island and all these places. Just different strokes for different folks. And it's never ending. It's never ending. That's what's nice.
Now, is there some kind of division or diversion between fly casters and regular fishermen? Like if they're on the same creek, or is there any animosity there?
Generally, no. But generally, the creeks are just set up. West Virginia doesn't have as many of catch and release as some other states. A lot of states have what they call delayed harvest. So the fly fishermen get a chance to have the early season, and then before the spinning guys, it opens up like in mid-May or something, like in North Carolina here. They got designated streams for designated fishing. Mm-hmm. West Virginia has a few designated fly fishing areas. But I wish they had a lot more. You know, I wish they had a lot more.
Yeah. Well, now you've even taken a step further with building fly fishing rods and just the example, I mean, just the hours and the meticulous work that put in. I mean, not your average Joe can't do that. And I've heard of, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I've heard of fly fishing rods out there that sells for as much as $3,000-$4,000 bucks. And
well, I was telling you earlier about this shop in Blue Ridge, Georgia. A guy named Bill Oyster makes these rods for celebrities and that kind of thing. And we're talking $16,000 to $20,000.
Wow.
That those kind of numbers. He made one for Jimmy Carter. And they estimate it to be 16,000.
Jeez.
So they're they consider it like fine violins, you know, and those kind of, and they last, you know, I mean, they're really, for a lot of folks, the bamboo deals are more about handing them down to future generations and et cetera.
I see. Now, are there any fly fishing shops, primarily just shops in West Virginia that you know of?
Oh, yeah.
Are there?
Oh, well, yeah. There's a good one. I haven't been to it, but there's a good one in Parkersburg, for sure. And the one at the Greenbrier is good. And there's some around Marlton there. that are pretty good.
I knew I'd seen one in Warrenton, Virginia when I was up there visiting my son, but I didn't know there was any in West Virginia. But let's talk about the salt water. You've been, tell us some of the places you've been and what type of fish you've been involved with.
Probably the most fun is, bone fishing. And that's just a little, generally speaking, they're only 16, 18 inches, maybe 3 pound bonefish is a great fish. And the way it's set up, you're on the end of a boat in the flats. It's very skinny water. It's not very deep. 2 feet deep is deep. And you're sight fishing. You're looking for them. And sometimes you get lucky and they're tailing and their tails are sticking up and you go, oh, there's one, you know, and you go after him. A lot of times, sometimes they're just swimming and the guide's up on a tower behind on the back of the boat and he can spot them way before you do. And and it's 10 feet, 20 feet, 30 feet, 1 o'clock, 1 o'clock, 1 o'clock. He's moving right to left, you know, and you have to pace your cast to what he's telling you if you don't pick up the sight and sight them. If you sight them, you're a lot closer to getting home with it. But, you know, there's a lot of discussion about that. But a 40, 50-foot shot is a long one because you just can't see them. Well, you hear people talk about how long their casts are and stuff. But that's cool. That's cool. But and these little fish will take all the fly line off it, and you go into what's called the backing. And so it's nothing for them to take that fish, take that all that line off your reel as so fast you can't even hardly see it. And the zoom, and all you're doing is holding on and laughing. And they're trying to head to the mangroves. If they get in the mangroves, they'll tangle you up. But that's really terribly exciting. That's really, really fun fishing. And
where do you fish for those mainly?
Best places I fished was below Cancun in an area called Boca Paella, and also over on the Bahamas side. And the best place I found was a little island called Long Island. And it's just a joy to be there. You get to know the people, after a while you get to know the people. And it's Stella Maris is the name of the place. And they're German. They came there after World War II and started the little lodge.
Have you ever fished for tuna or anything like that?
Well, yes.
Or swordfish?
Yeah. The last trip I took, we were in Costa Rica fishing primarily for sailfish. And it's incredible too. It's just like the movies. It's just like the movie you see. They jump so high, and on a quiet day you can hear the splash, just when they come back down, it's just boom. the last day we sailfished, we caught 9 in southern Costa Rica. But I fished for them several. I never caught one on the fly. It was one of my goals in life. But they don't, that's okay. And the big deal, for absolutely wonderful experience is Alaska. It's a fantastic experience.
You told me once that when you go to Alaska to fish, you don't, the weather, whatever, you don't know what to expect. You're going to fish regardless.
Yeah. It's you can expect to wear those waders all day for as long as you're there, 5 or 6 days, whether it's raining or not.
Yeah. Well, you like to cook fish as well as you like to fish?
Enjoy fishing, on the bank, I guess you might say. We cooked many a meal and had many a good time. And when you bring them home, I really enjoy them too. The best eating is walleye.
Yeah,
we went to Lake Erie several times, and fish for walleye. Boy, that's wonderful.
I never got the opportunity to fish much when I was a kid. I came from a single parent home and nobody ever took me out much. But when I got a little older, my oldest son showed a little inclination. He was only about 7 or 8 years old. So I actually took him up to Peterstown to the hatchery up there, and they'd have, you pay so much a pound or whatever, and he would catch fish till I ran out of $20, and then I'd stop him or something. But
I took my daughter Kelly up there many times.
They used to have these festivals there at that Peterstown hatchery, and Bob Bird used to come up and fish and sing and do all kinds of different things, but he developed a love to fish, and he's just now getting into the fly fishing.
Cool.
And he comes up to my farm, practices a little bit, know, this and that. But he needs to get some instruction, I think. But he's done a lot of trout and bass and those kind of things. My youngest son has done that too, but he's not as interested. Did you ever? Did you ever figure out what a Kirby bent was?
Yes, I did. You sent me right straight to the.
What is a Kirby bent?
It's just the bend of a fish hook as you know it. This some guy named Kirby back in England invented it, and it's the bend and a particular bend for mostly saltwater fishing, and the point of the barb is halfway up the shaft of the hook, and they lay flat.
Huh.
that's and thank you for getting me interested.
Pass that information along. Now, New River. There's guys that I got a buddy, Troy Stifler's got a floating fishing guide, and he fishes mainly around the Hinton area, and that's where they put in around and sometime down to Sandstone. But smallmouth bass is something else around that. And I'm one of the few. I haven't been that fortunate to catch a lot of fish, but one of my best experiences was on the New River. A neighbor of mine, Mike Harris, took me in a boat. We put in at Glade and went up to what they call Bennett Hole, actually, and floated down, fished, caught several smallmouth, took the boat back up, floated back down, and just a great, great day. And Mike, he's a pretty avid fisherman himself, but it's one of the best times I ever had. But there's people come in from all over.
Oh yeah,
the
New River's one of the best, very best smallmouth fisheries in the country. The South Branch of Potomac is good too, and it's renowned throughout the probably the world, and the Susquehanna River up comes into the Chesapeake from Pennsylvania is another great fishery. But they're very sensitive. I mean, all waters are very sensitive, and fish are sensitive to, I don't know if you want to call them pollutants or whatever. I mentioned the Susquehanna because the farms and the golf courses and stuff had so much nitrogen on them, and they went through a period of time where there was so much rain, it just almost wiped them out. Their fishery with all that nitrogen stuff coming into the water, the farmers got to raise his crops, all that's a balancing act. But the New River has not been hurt that badly. Now the pressure on the Greenbrier is it's just got a tremendous amount of pressure, and it's not as good as it was when I was growing up.
What's your favorite kind of fishing? If you had to go today, and what would you, if you had a choice, where would you go? What would you do?
If I was healthy, I would probably go back bone fishing somewhere. My number one target was a permit, a fish called a permit. And they outdid me. I went on 3 trips just for a permit and never caught a one. I got a few shots. I got shots and I got some hookups, but I never caught one. I was lucky enough to catch one on an ultralight spinner by total by accident, which that happens. But it's a nice picture. It's a great picture.
Now, you've been everywhere fishing all over North America. You've every state. You've been blessed, Bob.
Oh yes, I've been extremely blessed. Yeah, and a lot of it just right take place at the right time, and had folks that enjoyed it too. You know, I've went alone a few times to here and there, but it was just for some special occasion or something. But you want to go with folks. And as I grew older, less and less of my buddies fished, and that kind of put a kink in things. Mm-hmm. And so I had to figure out other ways to find folks to fish with. Because that's part of the whole experience is the camaraderie.
Yeah, that's good times. But well, listen, man, I appreciate you stopping by and talking to me. And feel free to come back anytime you want to. We got a lot we can talk about. I'm glad you come up all the way from Albany, Georgia, and a little hot down there right now.
That's going to be in the hundreds this week. Well, that's the first time we've had that, several days of the hundreds. You just stay inside. That's all you can do.
Yeah, but appreciate you coming by. Sir. And anybody else out there would like to be on the program, you can contact me at awbennett50@gmail.com, and we'll get you on here. Until next time, remember, if you're not dead yet, you're not done yet. And till next time, God bless you.
Tell your ma and pa everything's all right. We're gonna go fishing next Saturday night. Lipstick necked up, leave it behind. Makeup takes up too much time. You're a little honey and you're quite a niche. But Saturday night we're going fishing to fish. Don't forget the frying pan and bring along some dinners. Gonna catch a catfish and we'll cook him up for